evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back. The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm Phil Taylor. By the way, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And you can, of course, check us out, taylor-report.com, where we have all of our programs available. I hope I got my fingers crossed when I say that. Phil Conlon is also here. We're going to be speaking to Keith Boulder in a moment. Phil, you had an announcement.
Well, I just want to say that the earthquake in the Philippines was a very, very terrible thing. It's terrible beyond belief. And it is related to climate change. And this was predicted. And they said this is going to be the kind of thing that's going to happen because of climate change. But right now, people need immediate relief. And we do have some suggestions. There is the United Nations World Food Program, which is WFPUSA.org. There's a UNICEF.org support. Doctors Without Borders has a dedicated fund for the Philippine earthquake. So, I mean, yeah. if you want to give to Doctors Without Borders, make sure you specify that it is for the Philippine earthquake.
And on your program tomorrow at 12, you're going to
We're going to have this is the alternative November 11th. We're going to play Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, which, of course, is a cry against war that Britten wrote in 1960. And it is tremendously
great.
Respected work.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And now we have in our studio Keith Boulder, who's the author of Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution, and Its People. Welcome to the program, Keith. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Phil.
You look familiar.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Now, we were together yesterday, and I got to say, I was really pleased that at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, full house. It was standing room for three authors, one of whom was Keith, talking about three Canadian authors with different aspects of the story of Cuba. Of course, but we focus primarily on the issue of the five. And the, I believe, I know one of the sponsors of the meeting is the Free the Five. I got it. Free the Five, and the five is a numeral, tribunal.com. Free the Five, tribunal.com. Keith, this is my chance to question you. Yesterday, you got a lot of questions from people, but of course, I couldn't butt in because I was part of the panel. So now it's my turn. You told a story, which I think that people really need to know about, which is, and it grows out of, I know, your research for Cuba Under Siege. That is that medicine, some really essential contemporary medicine, which can save lives, is not available to the Cubans. And people were scratching their heads. How could that be? How could it not get there? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it was a great evening yesterday to have three Canadian authors together, and we all appreciated your being master of ceremonies there, Phil.
Yeah.
One of the aspects that people don't understand is the American embargo still encompasses certain medicines. Now, Cuba can buy medicines from any other country, including Canada, Latin America, Europe, but there's a number of medicines that the Americans have the total patent on that no other country can reproduce them generically. So the only place you can get these medicines is through the United States. And the book I wrote, Cuba Under Siege, I spent a week at a children's hospital, the William Soler Hospital in Havana, and talked to doctors, patients, the parents, and found out that the Cubans cannot purchase a dozen or so specific medicines for the treatment of children. Not that the Cubans don't want to. They have the money and they have the interest, but they can't buy these medicines because of the American embargo. And these medicines are having a really harmful effect. There's children dying in Cuba because the Cuban government cannot access these medicines. Mm-hmm. There's certain technologies that they can't access, but it's the medicines that have the most emotional impact because you're dealing with children.
Well, yeah, and you... I mean, you say there's other steps short of saving the life. I mean, you could do – people talk about solving these things, but meanwhile, people die. By the way, it's not only Cuba that they do this to, right? There are some other countries that they make this part of their embargo strategy.
Yeah, and again,
by the way, your word, I got to remind everybody, the title, Cuba Under Siege, people have to understand what a siege is and what's the point of a siege. It's to hurt people, right? And you stretched that rather well in the talk.
The American embargo, they've always, the media has always presented it that the embargo is against the Cuban government in order to free the Cuban people from the Fidel Castro regime, where in fact the American government has long recognized and noted that it's aimed entirely at the Cuban people to make their life so miserable that they'll overthrow their own government. It's just not presented publicly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the American government does have economic embargoes that encompass certain medicines against other countries, Iran being one of them, Iraq previous to the war. And it's something that the average American just doesn't understand or know, because these medicines are absolutely, they're modern technology, modern medicines that the Americans completely control.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so you mentioned, by the way, that Iraq policy. That in the case of Iraq, it did come to the fore because it went into that period of kind of a quasi war, where they began to keep track. I think the numbers have held up, as I understand. As a matter of fact, Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State, didn't even dispute the numbers when they said to her, 500,000 have died, mostly children, because of your policy. Is it worth it? We all know her famous answer was, we think so, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. She said, yeah, it was worth the death of a half a million children.
Half a million Iraqis, for the very reason that you outlined. In terms of the logic of it, that type of menace hangs over Cuba at any time, depending on how tightly or what type of relations the two states have, right?
The embargo has always been in place. There is a huge loophole that the Cuban government has been able to purchase food products from the United States through bilateral arrangements for the last 12 years. There was a hurricane that hit Cuba in 2001, and the Americans actually offered aid, material aid, food. And the Cuban government said, thank you, but we'd rather buy it. And so there was an arrangement through Congress in allowing that the Cuban government could purchase, under extremely restrictive conditions, certain amount of food from the United States. So they have been doing it to a lesser degree over the last few years, but the Cubans have spent billions of dollars buying American food stuff. But the embargo still remains in place. An American company can't go to Cuba and arrange it directly. It has to go through the American government. The Cubans have to pay up front all these restrictions. No Cuban products can be sold in the United States still. So the embargo is still having an incredibly harmful economic effect in Cuba.
Yeah. We're speaking to Keith Bolander. By the way, the book is Cuba Under Siege, and everybody really needs to get a copy of this, American Policy, the Revolution and Its People. And also, you pointed out that there's been this recent vote, which I don't know how it gets shrugged off. The vote on whether or not opposing this embargo at the General Assembly. Can you talk about that?
It's incredible. The United Nations once a year votes on the embargo. In mid-October, the Cuban government presented to the United Nations a report on the effects of the embargo, the blockade, and American hostility against the Cuban government and its people. And then 2 weeks later, this vote, the last vote was held October 29th. And it normally, in the last dozen years, it normally works out something like this. I'll take this year's vote. 188 countries voted against the embargo. They told the Americans, stop your punishment against the Cuban people. Two countries voted for the embargo, the United States and Israel. And it's funny, Israel has full diplomatic relations, full trade relations with Cuba. Normally, the last few years, there's been one, Pacific Island. Last year was Palau that voted for them. Even this year, they didn't. They abstained. Yeah. So it was 188 countries against the embargo and two countries, the United States and Israel, for it. And the Americans just don't care what international opinion is.
You know, they kind of reach that point where they're like this football player incognito or maybe our mayor. I mean, they just, they seem to be proud of their shamelessness, or proud of just how far cross the line, they can go as a way of demonstrating we can do this and no one can do anything about it.
The attitude often is that, you know, the Americans think they own the world, so they don't have to abide by what the rest of the world thinks of. And in Cuba, it's particularly interesting because a few years ago, an American official sort of let out the United States attitude towards this vote. And he said, well, we don't care what the United Nations votes. We don't care how many countries vote against the embargo. The differences between Cuba and the United States is a domestic issue.
Keith Bolander. Keith, could you analyze his? What does he mean by that?
Well, it's all based on the historical relationship
Somehow is an integral part of. Puerto Rico, perhaps?
The
Puerto Ricans would say yes.
You're right. The Puerto Ricans would. The Americans still haven't recognize that Cuba has been a sovereign country for the last 55 years since the triumph of the revolution. They haven't gotten over the fact. So for them to even recognize Cuba as a sovereign nation is the first step. And the second step is to treat them like a sovereign nation, and no nation would do what the Americans have done to Cuba. So it's really based on the historical attitude when the United States owned Cuba for 60 years, and they still haven't forgiven the Cubans for the triumph of the revolution.
You know, we seem to have the flotsam and jetsam of colonialism, or maybe the virus. The French were this way with Haiti, right? Haiti was paying for the slaves. When they ended slavery, France demanded for recognition that they pay them the value of themselves. You know, the bodies had to pay for those slaves, and they didn't finish paying till 1957.
Which crippled the Haitian economy, and it still has an effect to this day.
Yeah, I mean, the colonial mind is something, and the U.S. looks at Cuba that way. It's you must know this probably better than I do. They at one time, the Confederate side of the American psyche, intended to colonize Cuba and make it a slave dominion of the U.S.
Yeah, the Cuba was the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery, and one of the rationales for the United States to take Cuba was that they would enter the Union as a slave state. So the Confederate southern part of the United States was extremely interested in taking Cuba. And in fact, the Americans tried to buy Cuba from the Spanish for about $300 million, and the Spanish said no. But there was a huge influence to have the Cuba come into the United States on the side of the slave state. Now, after the Civil War, that ended.
Yeah, that was part of it. And a matter of fact, they operated out of there. But certainly, this I raised Puerto Rico. By the way, the Puerto Ricans they consider themselves, you know, brothers and sisters of Cuba, and it's not discussed again in American politics very much. But the Puerto Ricans, of course, have a very close feeling for Cuba, follow their affairs, and they say to Cuba, "You're lucky. This is what we've got. Is what would have happened to you had you not fought yourself free."
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny in the first decade or so of the revolution, the Cuban government did not look terribly favorably on Puerto Rico because of their perception of being part of the United States. And the Puerto Rican and Cuba had very, very difficult relations in the first years of the revolution.
Yeah, because it was a shining example. Every leading Puerto Rican nationalist figure wanted to be in Havana. and to say, here we are, we're brothers, you know, and that frightened the U.S. government, and still does, frankly.
And there's still Puerto Rican nationalists in jail.
Very curious thing about them that I notice is that they say, you know, you have a debate over statehood, and it's never resolved. Puerto Rico is not a state. It's some peculiar definition where you get to be an American, but you're not really an American. They say, so you have the nationalists and then you have those who want statehood. But if you actually listen to Puerto Ricans, it's two types of nationalists arguing. What would be best for the national people of Puerto Rico, the nation, to be a full state, or to be truly independent. They're awfully close to one another, even though they're bitterly, you know, arguing. But if you, their rationale is Puerto Rico oriented. It's not, oh boy, I want to live in Texas. No, it's they want to be able to exercise more rights as Puerto Ricans.
And eventually,
somewhat like Washington D.C., which is not a state either. It's a majority black population with no congressional representation.
Exactly. It's an odd situation.
It's an occupied city. I've gotten this off course slightly. We're talking to Keith Bolander. His book is Cuba Under Siege, American Policy and Revolution and Its People. And yesterday you were speaking together with Stephen Kimber and Arnold August. And I noticed that the three of you had been speaking together elsewhere. You, of course, up at York, but you've been sort of making something like a tour. Is that right?
This was the first time – sorry, the second time. On Friday, we had an event at York University, but just – coincidentally, Arnold, who has written a number of books on Cuba democracy, was touring the United States, and I just had come back from a tour in the United Kingdom. I was in England, Ireland, and Scotland for a month, and it's funny, the Scottish are going through the same questioning of whether they want complete independence. Next year they're having a referendum whether to completely separate from England or not. So it was very interesting.
Could you tell us about what was it like? What were the audiences like? What was on their mind? What kind of questions?
Well, in Scotland was really interesting because of their relationship with England historically. And so a lot of the questions were based on the historical relationship between the United States and Cuba when America controlled Cuba for the 60 years from 1902 to 1959. So a lot of the questions were more historical, and a lot were interested in what's happening in Cuba now with the economic reforms, mm-hmm. and Fidel's health and what Raul is going through. But the most questions that I face about the historical relationship between Cuba and the United States was in Scotland. And it might have been a reflection of what they're thinking of doing, whether they're going to vote mm-hmm. for full independence. As I said, the referendum's taking place next year. So they're going through a little shift in their thinking of whether they want to maintain relations with Britain, or what level they want to maintain relations with England, or if they want to completely separate.
They're going to have an independent foreign policy. I mean, that actually, I mean, this is somewhat a kind of a glimpse of our own history here, which is, okay, now it's defined as an independent country, but it seems to sound like somebody nearby, you know, and there's a woman on all of our stamps and that kind of thing who none of us have ever, you know, she's not from this part of town, I know that, which makes people wonder, you know, how independent. I mean, the Scots have to worry, knowing England, and they certainly do, and the Irish are considered authorities, as they well should be, and so they have to wonder how whether they would encounter a kind of punitive atmosphere such as happened to Cuba with the United States.
Well, it was interesting in Ireland. The Irish Revolution, we went to a number of museums and historical places, and we started finding similarities between the Irish Revolution and the Cuban Revolution, mm-hmm. between the British imperialism at the time and the unrecognized American imperialism over Cuba. And a number of people that we met in Ireland talked about, you know, in their revolution and what it's meant to their country, and in support with the Cuban Revolution. There's a tremendous amount of support and connection between Ireland and Cuba.
Yeah. No, I think, by the way, I mean, and I know your writing fleshes this out, and this Cuban experience, the phenomena, has really moved around the world, because Fidel, particularly in the period when he was really at the helm and such an articulate man, became for so many people their guy. You know, they would listen to the local leader, but they wouldn't know what Fidel thought, because he had obviously taken the dragon by the tail and still had him. Him and the dragon were still going around. And a lot of, you know, nations looked to the Cubans. And you went into it. I mean, and others you know, the U.S. blocked Cuba from being part of South American organization. But look who's now part of the, you know, integral part of South American politics.
One of the strategies of American regime change was to isolate Cuba from the rest of the Americas and the rest of the world. They were very effective. Only Mexico and Canada maintained relations. And one of the reasons, one of the rationales for the isolation was that Cuba was exporting its revolution. Well, they have exported it, and it succeeded because Latin America is closer to Cuba now than at any other time. The only country that's isolated now is the United States.
Yes. I mean, just think of that. I mean, the Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. I mean, when you think South America and Bolivia, they all are quite comfortable and are loudly backing Cuba.
And Cuba has good relations with the right-wing governments, Colombia. So Cuba's relation and Cuba's influence within Latin America is extremely solid now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've taken this up. I recall when we had the what do they call it here? I only know it as the Malvinas on the Malouines. What are the British?
Falklands.
Yeah. Yes. The British call it the Falklands. The British went after them and Fidel immediately said, "Hey, no, get out of here. You are British colonialists. You have nothing to do here." And the Argentines all said, "It was like a whiplash." What? And there was Fidel, and he was invited to Buenos Aires. He said, "Come."
And that was a pretty right-wing government
exactly,
in Argentina at
said,
that point.
But he said, "This is a national issue. And this is a colonial question." By the way, we had a premier in Quebec named René Lévesque, and he, of course, kept coughing. Our government would say, "Well, we stand with the British on the Falklands," and then you hear this cough, and then Lévesque would say, "The Malouines," and they said, "Never mind him. I'm talking about the and the Malouines, please." And we had this battle. Frankly, now it's the Malvinas. I mean, something is happening here. And if they have another go-round, which is possible, South America will line up, and the British would be unwise to try to press their case. But to my mind, that was a display of Fidel and, I should say, the Cubans representing actually a understanding of the larger picture. It wasn't a self-centered analysis. They didn't say, "Oh, well, these guys are ideologically different, and therefore we don't." No, it was a very sophisticated position.
Fidel always had a strong sense of Latin America. Even when Latin America rejected the revolution and kicked the Cubans out of the OAS, Fidel always stood for a sense and identity of Latin America. Well, I really believe that identity has come to fruition now, much greater than it ever has in the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. And the Americans are very much looking on the outside compared to how they were involved previously.
Yeah. No, it is a very great moment in history. By the way, it gives us some hope, does it not? And we're speaking to Keith Bolliter, Cuba Under Siege, American Policy and the Revolution and Its People. Keith, you make that point that Fidel has always been of this point of view. And when Hugo Chavez died, I noticed that they reprinted a speech, or the Cubans did, a speech that Fidel had given in Caracas, in which he said, "You're the big uncle. You're the ones. People talk about us, but you are the leaders. We of Cuba want to support you."
Yes, very much so.
And he said that in the 60s.
Exactly, and it's now you're seeing that come to truth, and regardless of how the Americans want to treat Latin America now, Latin America is standing on its own 2 feet, and a lot of that credit has to go to Cuban influence.
Yeah, when he gave those remarks in Caracas, there was a sea of people listening. And he wasn't reading from a text. He was telling them something that they all needed to know. And frankly, we all did. I mean, I wish we would talk more in terms of hemispheric politics. We share this hemisphere with South Americans and all those states and with Cuba. And we would all benefit here if we knew better and more in detail their thoughts and analysis. Starting, of course, with Fidel himself. Well, thank goodness we have your book, Cuba Under Siege. This is Keith Bolliter. And Keith, An odd story was told yesterday. I wanted to get you to kind of repeat it, give your thoughts. One of the, I think it was Arnold August mentioned, that people tried to buy his book on PayPal. And the State Department or somebody got in touch with him and said, no, you can't buy Arnold August's book. Can you elaborate on that story?
PayPal has, for a number of years, there's other incidences where PayPal has refused a transaction because their position was it would be in contravention of American embargo. There was an English travel agency that wanted to use PayPal for some payments for English tourists coming to Cuba, nothing to do with the United States, and the American government stepped in and PayPal supported the government's position, so wouldn't allow these transactions to take place. PayPal is not a friend of Cuba.
See, that's an intrusion on the affairs of private Canadians, citizens, we're supposed to be protected by our state. That they're supposed to say, no, you can't do that. That's a Canadian going about his business.
There are Canadian laws prohibiting Canadian companies to conform to American extraterritoriality aspects of the Helms-Burton law against Cuba. And there's not one Canadian subsidiary doing business, subsidiary of an American company doing business in Cuba anymore because of American pressure, despite the fact these Canadian businesses are legal entities inside of Canada. American influence and American pressure is all over.
We're speaking to Keith Ballender in the last minutes here. I want to make sure I just underline that embargo is totally illegal, is it not? To speak and act towards a state the way the United States has towards Cuba is, if Cuba doesn't engage in a war, but the acts being taken against them are themselves acts of war.
Yeah, by most international standards, the blockade, the embargo is illegal. The Americans do consider themselves still at war against Cuba under the Trading with the Enemy Act that President Obama continues to sign. But by any standard, the embargo is really against any international recognized legal.
Yeah. And I got to get you to pronounce on that subject. We now have a Harvard liberal running the country, and everybody put their hearts into that. And we watched Oprah weeping and everything when he was elected. But how different has his policy been?
In fact, it's gotten worse in some aspects. He's made things worse for the Cubans to conduct international banking transactions. He was in Miami just this week talking to some hardline pro-embargo Cuban Americans. I don't think anything will change under Obama, yeah. Unfortunately.
This is Keith Ballender, and thank goodness you're here and you underline that fact, because we mustn't have any illusions. My impression, the best I get from this, is that, you know, the world is waking up, and more the U.S. is the one. So Keith Ballender, really grateful that you came in. It's Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution and Its People. Palgrave Publisher, please get this book. You've been listening to The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll see you next week.